The Everything Apartments podcast is provided with support from the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles, better known as AGLA, serving residential landlords throughout Southern California through education and advocacy. Visit aagla.org. Welcome to the Everything Apartments podcast. I'm your host, Eric Christopher. And on this podcast, we cover all topics of multifamily investments, from buying and financing properties, day-to-day operations and management, and also reinvestment strategies. This is episode 28. Scroll back in whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on and check out some of the back episodes. There's some really great topics and guests, just like we have today. Also, we love getting your questions about this or any past episode. So if you have any questions, please call, text, or email us. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see the contact information right on the screen. If you're listening only, it will be in the show notes of the episode. Apartment financing is a continuously changing topic and obviously a huge component of most purchases. As many of us know, we've experienced a cycle over the last 7 to 8 years with outlandishly low rates available for apartment refinance and purchase. As with most things in real estate, that operates in a cycle as well. The financing is a component that's big enough that its momentum alone is enough to actually turn a cycle, and we are seeing that happen right now. Today, we have a great guest who is an expert in the topic of apartment and commercial real estate finance, and we'll all get up to speed on exactly what's going on the lending side of the business. But first, I'll tell you about our firm, WSC Realty Advisors and WSC Property Management. WSC has been helping buyers and sellers and managing properties in Long Beach for over 16 years. If you're tired of managing your units or just not getting the results you want, WSC can help. WSC never wants to be the biggest firm in Long Beach. Instead, we stay a little smaller and more agile to bring the quality you need. We can also help you if you're looking to acquire more units here or maybe an exchange scenario to an out-of-state market. Visit wsc-pm.com. Call, text, or email us. All that information is in the show notes. Or if you're watching on YouTube, it's right next to me. Mention the Everything Apartments podcast and get your first 2 months of management absolutely free. Whatever your challenge with your property, WSC has the solution. Today we have with us Michael Presser, Senior Director of Walker & Dunlap. They're a nationwide commercial real estate lending platform, which acquired his former firm, George Elkins Mortgage Banking Company, in 2016. Mike has over 20 years experience in commercial real estate financing, with experience working with a wide array of capital sources, including life insurance companies, CMBS. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Banks, credit unions, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, of course, with the multifamily, private debt funds, private equity funds, and pension funds. So basically, if we're talking about commercial real estate financing, Mike knows a lot about it. Mike's closed over $4 billion of financings, ranging from permanent bridge, construction loans, mezzanine lines of credit, joint venture equity. Great resource to bring us up to speed on what's going on in that segment of the market right now. Mike graduated from UCLA, got his MBA from Anderson Graduate School of Management with an emphasis in real estate and finance. And also, Mike is a member of the ULI. If you don't know what that is, that's the Urban Land Institute, Orange County Capital Markets Product Council. That's a really good organization around kind of the entire commercial real estate market, is the Urban Land Institute. Former member of the ULI Orange County Next Project Council, and is also a member of the CFBA, CMBA, and the Los Angeles Mortgage Association. Mike, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Eric.
So let's talk about something way more important than business for a minute. I noticed you went to UCLA. What did you think of that game last Saturday night?
Actually, I was out of town. I was in Mexico, and they didn't have any TVs where I was, but I was tracking it on my phone. I saw after the fact that we had a couple of cracks at stealing that win away, even down two of our starters. So that's an encouraging sign going into the tournament.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not the biggest basketball fan in the world, but certainly, you know, you get to a game like that. And then I'm more Southern California oriented, but I have a son that goes to U of A. So I didn't really have a dog in the fight, but I'll tell you, it's one of the most exciting basketball games I've seen in a long time. So yeah, definitely glad both teams made it to the tournament. Hopefully we'll see some more excitement like we did last Saturday.
Definitely.
Getting to the financing side of a commercial real estate, and specifically apartments, just kind of a recent newsworthy thing we can touch on real quick. Do you see any blowback coming for, say, apartment financing around a potential banking crisis, meaning reading into this SVB meltdown and then some of the contagion that could happen from that? Do you feel like that could affect the commercial real estate financing market?
Definitely going to have some impact in what I'm already seeing and hearing from some of the capital sources, specifically banks, really. They're the ones that are going to be impacted the most. Banks are concerned about their liquidity positions. So we're seeing banks start to that are normally transactional banks. You know, they're happy to just finance your multifamily loan without requiring deposits. Well, now, after the SVB and Signature Bank failures, we're seeing banks start to require deposits, which is a departure. And I know is not something that a lot of borrowers like, that, you know, they have their particular banking relationship for their deposits. And separately, they like to go to a separate, you know, bank that is competitive on the multifamily finance side. So that kind of gums up the works. And then separately, I've heard a couple of different anecdotes from banks that regulators are coming in and scrutinizing their liquidity. And so we've already heard some banks pulling back or pulling out of the market, at least in the short term, on the permanent loan financing side for multifamily.
So kind of a double blow, where you've already seen graduation out of this historically low interest rate environment. I'm not sure when you would tell me that started, but it went on a hell of a long time. I don't know, 2015 and on.
Right.
Where maybe not you, but a lot of us that aren't around that stuff every day say, wow, I never thought rates could get this low on an, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 unit apartment building. And certainly many took advantage of that down in the, could have been mid three levels on a fully amortized 5-year fixed loan. But those days are obviously gone now. So for a lot of us that may not have as much of a pulse on this as you do, tell us, how is the relation to Fed rate increases, or I guess, or decreases? How does that correlate to apartment financing?
Yeah. So on, you know, from a 30,000 foot point of view, most sources of capital to finance multifamily, whether it's banks, whether it's CMBS, whether it's the agencies. And when I say the agencies, I mean Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or whether it's life insurance companies, they price over equivalent treasury. So if you did a 5-year fixed rate loan with a bank, they're typically going to price that over the 5-year treasury rather than the Fed funds rate. And the 5-year treasury or the 7-year treasury or even the 10-year treasury, those are dictated by supply and demand in the market, whereas the Fed only can control the short end of the curve, you know, by moving the Fed funds rate up or down. And so unless you're doing floating rate financing, which is usually priced indirectly over the Fed funds rate, it's not a direct correlation. It's indirect, but you're not going to see a direct correlation. So on stuff right now, you know, the 5-year treasury I looked earlier today is somewhere around 3.5%, and then you're going to get a spread above that. So depending on the bank and their appetite, maybe they're from 5.75% to 6.5% if they're active. Fannie and Freddie, I would say, are actually a little bit more competitive now than the banks, just because their source of capital is different than the banks. The banks have to pay, you know, their source of capital is demand deposits. And we've seen demand deposits, the interest rate on that go from banks having to pay 0%. Now there are some banks are paying north of 4% on their demand deposits. So that that impacts banks to a much greater degree than any of the other sources of capital.
Some turbulence going on in that segment of the financing, but I have found, you know, on a lot of the private owner, you know, let's say mid to high six-figure loans, and maybe even a little higher, it seems like those come from mainly banks. And then when you get larger into more institutional stuff, is that kind of when the other sources open up a little bigger?
Yeah, I would say anything sub $1 million is almost exclusively going to come for a bank or a credit union. The other sources of capital, for a variety of reasons, prefer deals. Let's say they start at kind of $1.5 million on the loan size. And that's due to transaction costs. You know, you don't want to have a ton of transaction costs that come in the form of some lender legal or a property condition report or a seismic report, in addition to a phase one and an appraisal. So when you add all those things together, that gets expensive for a loan that's maybe $500,000 or $600,000. So you're better off just going to a bank that has cheaper cost of execution.
Sure. And sometimes they're incentivizing with, you know, massively low closing costs, or just so they can be aggressive at times. And yeah, down below that $1 million number, it seems like that's where you'll be at. taking kind of a step back, and I'm very cautious about not trying to play economist. I mean, I read what I read, like a lot of people. I'm definitely not an expert outside of just kind of casually looking. But as far as the next year or say 18 months looks like, what are your thoughts on increases? From what I can see, the Fed's got a problem because we've got this inflationary cycle just killing us. They've already had some increases. What do you see happening next 12 to 18 months?
So I think, so the next Fed meeting is next week, actually. And I can tell you, Chairman Powell came out with some comments, I think a week ago, give or take. And he basically said, hey, inflation's still out of control. Expect more rate increases. Subsequent to that, we had these two bank failures. And the expectation from the market, give or take a week ago, is that about an 80% chance of another 50 basis point bump coming next week. That's dropped all the way down to a 50-50 coin flip between a 25 basis point rate hike and no rate hike at all next week. So definitely a drop in expectations. But if I had to guess, European Central Bank today came out with a 50 basis point rate hike in spite of all the headlines that are coming out. So I suspect there will be a 25 basis point hike next week. And it wouldn't surprise me if they take their foot off the gas at that point and let it sit there, read the tea leaves on the economy for the next couple of months.
Okay, so taking that all in, you know, we all knew where we were in rate structure and, you know, underwriting and whatnot. Maybe, you know, as early as 9 months ago, the market felt kind of normal. And then you start seeing these increases. So let's say on a core $2 million loan on a bread and butter apartment building in Long Beach, tell me about the differences, maybe not only in just rate, but okay, 9 or 12 months ago, the underwriting criteria could be LTV, DCR, all that good stuff that drives the whole thing. What's changed? What are the main things you're seeing as like challenges now that maybe weren't a year and a half ago?
So, I mean, the biggest thing is obviously the increase in the interest rates that lenders are offering. So I can tell you, I have an example. I did a loan for a good client almost 12 months ago to the day. And we did a life company 10-year interest only loan. And that loan was priced in the 3.75 range. And so when you look at cash flows, right, it underwrites on a debt coverage basis all day long at that great low rate. Fast forward 12 months, now you're going to be looking at a rate 5.5, 6, maybe 6.25%, depending on the type of execution. Your debt coverage constrained on everything right now. So LTV doesn't even come into play anymore. Whereas when we had low rates, you could push LTV, you know, 70, 75, even 80%, depending on the kind of cap rate that you were dealing with on the asset. Now I just ran some quick numbers. If you're buying a 4-cap deal and you're getting 5.75% money, the maximum loan you can get because of debt coverage constraints is probably 47 or 48% LTV. So the leverage level has just come down significantly. So more capital intense, you need more equity to do deals. That's the biggest impact. And that's, you know, the thing that borrowers are going to have to adjust to over time.
Okay. And just taking a step back, because I know my listenership is wide variety in expertise and frequency, and the LTV is loan to value. That's a pretty easy one to think about as the percentage of the total purchase that's going to be covered by financing. I'm pretty sure I know what DCR is, but give me the Dr. Seuss version just for somebody that's never heard that term.
Yeah. So DCR, debt coverage ratio, is basically lenders are going to look at the cash flow on your property, regardless of whether your property is 100% occupied or not. They're going to underwrite at least a 5% vacancy. If the actual vacancy of a property is greater than 5%, they'll use actual. They're going to underwrite, some lenders are going to underwrite taxes at market or at the loan amount, rather than if you've owned a property for 30 years, your property taxes are going to be way below either of those expense numbers. So they're going to go down your expense list and underwrite what they consider to be market expenses. And that's when an appraiser goes out to, you know, do a study on the property and look at comps. The appraiser is going to conclude, okay, here are what market expenses are. The lender is going to use those rather than actual expenses almost every time. So cash flows are going to get dinged by vacancy. They're going to get, and oftentimes they're going to get hit with higher expenses. And that's going to leave them the lender's net operating income number that they then underwrite. And they need a a 1.2 times ratio of the debt service relative to their underwritten net operating income.
Lee, I've been through this a couple times where I have a property with my family that we've had for 12 years and it runs really well under the normal expense ratio that maybe, you know, the average building would run on. And I had a couple conversations with the lender when we refied, you know, 5 years ago. It's like, well, I've got 10 years worth of operating data that tell you my expenses are this, and they're padding those. Risk mitigation factor, as far as I can tell, like I've got 0% vacancy for the last 4 years. Obviously, we could buy into 3, but the bank sounds like they're going to do 5 across the board. It seems like they've done that for a long time, right?
Right. And the way that banks and lenders look at it is, okay, if I were to ever take this property back, I'm not an expert at operating this thing. So, you know, they consider them, you know, they look at it as, hey, I'm going to be an average operator. And so I'm going to underwrite an average vacancy and the market average on expenses. And if my cash flow still size is okay, I'm good that way. But that's the way a lender is going to look at it.
So understanding what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, the DCR or the debt coverage ratio is the main constraint with the rise in interest rates.
Correct. Because lenders are willing to go, depending on the lender, life companies are the most conservative. Let's say they'll go up to 60 or 65% loan to value on their underwriting. Typically, a bank or a credit union, 75, sometimes 80%, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, 75 to 80% if it's acquisition, and CMBS usually 75%. But that's also subject to the debt coverage constraint, and they have a separate criteria that they have to meet on that front. And right now, given what interest rates have done over the last 12 months, that is without exception the limiting factor on loan dollars for any purchase or refinance.
So just to be kind of redundant and succinct about this, so the lender's underwriting their way, they're applying their benchmark vacancy and expenses that they're comfortable with. Then you have basically you could call it a lender's net income, and they're going to take the loan payment and divide it by that number to see how many times, in this case, a fraction, how many times that cash flow could cover the debt service. And from what I'm heard, and that's kind of a common number I'm used to, is your lender's cash flow needs to come in at 1.2 times the debt service payment. Is that kind of where you're at on that right now?
That's correct. And just to add some additional color time back to earlier, a couple of years ago, and you may have experienced this on purchases, we were seeing lenders go down to a 1.15 ratio on purchases. That's migrated back up to 1.20. And in talking to some banks over the last several days, some banks have adjusted that out to 1.25 times ratio. So there's definitely on the bank side a trend in the more conservative direction, whereas with some of the other lenders, they are now becoming a little bit more aggressive on how they'll underwrite cash flows, because they're not suffering from this bank deposit and liquidity issue like the banks are.
Understood. So your example, maybe, you know, with our little bit of color around this for some of the folks that maybe haven't spent a lot of time thinking about this, you mentioned just a couple minutes back, if you were fathoming buying a 4.5% cap rate apartment loan or apartment property using the new rate, which you're indicating, yeah, could be 6 or 6.25%, that DCR number is going to constrain you at under 50% to the loan.
So at a 4.5 cap, I ran the numbers, you're probably maybe 53%. At a 4 cap, you were sub 50. At a 5 cap, you're approaching 60% loan to value. But that's, you know, and you know better than I do what kind of cap rates are out in the market right now. But I've heard 4.5. And so at a 4.5, you're 53% LTV, 54% LTV, using a high 5% interest rate and a 30-year amortization to calculate that debt coverage ratio.
Obviously, location and asset quality are going to be all over the board, especially in a town like Long Beach. There's a lot of towns in Orange County that are pretty homogenous in asset quality, whereas in Long Beach, you have the whole gamut. Certainly what we've seen happen in the past, and I'm, you know, we kind of intonated on this in the beginning, is that this financing thing is a big enough elephant in the room that it can drive markets. And what should happen. We've seen it happen before, and it does take a little bit of time. I've found that buyers and sellers in the market usually lag reality by about 4 to 6 months, where somebody who's looking at doing a refi or a purchase right now has an assumption built in their head that's about 6 months old. Now you get them to the table where you give them the, you know, the loan offer sheet or the preliminary indication, their mouth drops open. A lot of people have learned that the rates are going up, but what they may not think about is how that LTV, or I'm sorry, how that DCR is going to constrain that loan. Do you have 50% down? Now, on an A-class property in Long Beach, certainly we're still seeing like 4 cap, but in a lot more, say, of the blue collar and let's say C-grade areas, those are going to be the cap rates that unwind quicker. We didn't see much erosion in a Belmont Shore or Naples or Belmont Heights, just using Long Beach A-class neighborhoods. We didn't see a lot of erosion in price in the Great Recession, where we saw quite a bit in the tougher areas. So we will, I think maybe, and you tell me what you think when I get down here, you will see this financing start driving price to a degree. Is that kind of what you're seeing maybe popping up here in the next 12 to 18 months?
Yeah. And we've had this discussion internally. So we have a big investment sales platform, and really those guys do kind of institutional size and quality deals all over the country. I think they did about $20 billion in sales last year. And so the discussion is always going on whether financing drives prices and cap rates, or whether it's flow of funds. And basically what all the investment sales guys on our platform say is it's flow of funds. And what I mean by that is how much money is being allocated, whether it's from private investors, institutional investors, foreign investors, into this particular asset class. And the reason that I bring that up is because while financing for kind of smaller owners, I think definitely plays a bigger piece, crisis in confidence that I think is happening this week, that's diminishing the amount of capital that's going to flow into this market segment and all of commercial real estate, at least in the short term. So I think it's definitely going to have a negative impact on values, and you're going to continue to see cap rates drift up.
Mike, you were mentioning earlier there's different sources of financing, and the smaller apartment loans are typically through a bank. Take us a little further through on these different outlets and maybe where they plug in best.
Yeah, so I think we already covered the banks as far as kind of what their appetite is, what we're seeing in that segment. We're definitely seeing pullback from some of the typical players. So there's going to be less competition there. There are several other segments, as you alluded to. One of them is life insurance companies. Now, the way that I would characterize life insurance companies is starting at $1 million, $1.5 million loan amount, they become players. Anything below that is too small. I would characterize them as the low price leader and the most conservative when it comes to underwriting. So if you've owned a property forever and you just want to refinance the outstanding balance of $2 million, and you want the best rate, and you're going to pass this on to your estate or whatever it may be, and you're never going to sell it, then the life companies become a player for that, right? They're good at longer term fixed rate money. They can do everything from 3-year fixed all the way out to 25 years fixed. They can do fully amortizing loans. They can, you know, meaning they could do a 25 year fully amortizing loan. They can do a 10-year term with a 30-year amortization. If the asset is high enough quality, they can do a 10-year term with some interest only. And they generally have the best pricing. And just to kind of give you an order of magnitude, I would say right now, after the hiccup we've had in the last week with these banks, spreads have gone out for basically all lenders. But I would say on the low end, a life company might price it at 165 or 170 basis points over the treasury. So just to give you an actual example, I think the 10-year treasury as of today is 3.4%. Add 1.7% onto that, and you're looking at a 5.1% rate as kind of a best case scenario from a life company right now. And the range would be from 5.1 maybe to 5.5, depending on the deal characteristics, location, leverage, borrower strength and experience, all that good stuff. So that's life companies. They're more restrictive on prepay. So they don't give you the flexibility to move in and out of an asset. But if you know you're going to hold it for a long time, that's a good alternative to consider. And on top of that, you have the agencies, which is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are very good at 5, 7, and 10-year money. They are also very good at interest only. They're a little bit more restrictive when it comes to borrower structures. They have some more hoops to jump through on most occasions relative to a bank. Some borrowers have owned their property in their own name versus an LLC. That can prove problematic for Fannie and Freddie, they may ask you to put it into an LLC. They're also very good. Their pricing is, let's call it 5.5% to 6%. So I think we came out of a market about a year ago where I think banks were more competitive in pricing. Now I would say that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are more competitive in pricing than banks are, and they can get to higher loan dollars than the banks can because they have a lower rate. One other nuance is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are exclusively non-recourse lenders. So for some borrowers, they don't care. For other borrowers, that's kind of a deal issue. So banks can do it if it's low enough leverage. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac across the board are non-recourse lenders, all the way up to if you can get to 75 or 80% leverage if it underwrites for it. And the last segment is CMBS. I would say CMBS is probably the lender of last resort right now because they have the most exposure to market conditions, number one. And number two, they typically can't lock rate until you're a couple of days from closing. So you have a ton of interest rate exposure while you're working through the process for 60 days. And I would categorize their interest rate as somewhere in the mid sixes right now.
As far as Fannie and Freddie go on loan size, where do they kind of kick in as a viable option? Is it still above seven figures?
Yeah. So I think Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac both have small loan programs, and they run from, call it, $1.5 million up to $6 or $7 million, depending on which one you're talking about. And then they have their regular loan program, which starts above that. And the small loan programs generally have more limited costs. They have some other bells and whistles. The Freddie Mac small loan program can offer step down prepay on 5-year money. So they could do a 5%, 4%, 3%, 2%, 1%, which looks very similar to a lot of banks. That's who they're trying to compete with their small loan programs. Freddie Mac, one other nuance is Freddie Mac can lock rate at application, which is beneficial for those borrowers that don't want that interest rate exposure and are used to bank execution. Fannie Mae, the negative on Fannie Mae is they do not lock rate at application on their small loan program. Having said that, they're generally a little bit better on rates and pricing right now relative to Freddie.
A lot of places to take a loan that's above $1 million or $1.5 million. There's plenty of sources in the banking side that will handle you below that. Let's leave it there. And what I will do is put your contact information in the show notes. That way, if somebody's got more questions, maybe they have a potential need that they need taken care of, they can call you up and ask you questions about that. It was really a pleasure having you on today. I learned something new every time I have a guest on, and today was definitely one of those days.
Eric, appreciate you having me on, and hopefully I was able to share some info that might help some of your listeners out there.
Thank you for listening to the Everything Apartments podcast. I'm your host, Eric Christopher. Stay tuned for another episode coming soon.